Hi, Katie. Hi, Cats. We are back.
Hi, Katie.
Hello, Dominic. Hello, Cats.
For the third and final installment of the Oatly Chronicles, our investigative series looking at the Swedish oat milk brand, Oatly.
If you haven't heard the first two episodes, go back and listen to the first two parts immediately.
Immediately.
Right now. But if you have listened to the first two episodes, then we can carry on. Where are you taking us today, Kats?
Yes, this final week, we are looking into what has happened to Oatly. So far, we have learned that dairy is terrible for the planet, right up there with burning fossil fuels. And Oatly says that in order to defeat the almighty dairy industry, it's prepared to take on some very controversial investments. So today, the question is, how has Oatly changed since it took on those investments?
I'm intrigued.
So when we last left Oatly, it was 2020. The company was bulging with all of this controversial money, and off they went. Oatly opened new factories. Its products hit the supermarket shelves in more and more countries, and they ballooned from being a startup with about 100 people on their staff to a full-blown multinational with 2,000 employees.
Whoa.
In the last episode, we spoke to Fredrik Gerten, a film director from Malmö, who had a lot of friends who worked at Oatly back in its startup phase, back when Oatly presented itself as a radically different company, a company of underdogs wanting to make the world a better place. But now, in this period of big expansion, he told us a lot of those people left.
Because it was less fun to be connected with it. There was a feeling that the employees and the owners were on a journey together. Those journeys went apart at that moment. And it's all gone, that image of being that special company that people came to once upon a time. I think people now understand that this is just a corporation. For me, it's a sad story.
A sad story for Fredrik, perhaps, but for the Oatly execs, things were going great.
And slowly but surely, Oatly became almost a household name in Europe and the US. And then in 2021, Oatly launched what is known in the investment world as an IPO, an initial public offering.
Thank you, Katie, for providing us with a bit more jargon.
As always.
Can you explain it for me?
Yeah, so it means that outside investors could start buying and selling shares in Oatly.
Ah, so you mean not just the Jay-Z's and Blackstones of the world can invest, but a random person like me could buy a share?
Yeah, eventually a random person like you, but mostly to begin with, massive banks and hedge funds. And launching an IPO, it's a really big deal for any company.
And how did it go?
Well, on day one, it went super, super well. Oatly launched on the New York Stock Exchange on May the 20th, 2021, and the price of the shares jumped like 30% that day.
Wow, that sounds good.
At Oatly HQ in Malmö in Sweden, they were like, woohoo, this is a ton of new money that we can invest in growing the company.
Oatly raised $1.43 billion in its IPO, a sum that will be used to expand capacity amid surging demand for its oat milk and other plant-based products. Let's welcome in Oatly's longtime CEO, Tony Peterson. Tony, good to see you this morning here. As I just mentioned, that is a large slug of money that you just raised from your IPO. How do you plan to allocate that capital?
Super excited to be here. You know, it's to build out our production capacity across the three continents. We're gonna build additional three factories up to 2023. So to capture the demand that we are generating across the three continents.
So for Oatly, things were looking golden, but it wasn't long before the road got rocky.
Factories that have been built way more slowly than scheduled. Their sales haven't grown anything like as fast as they hoped. The company hasn't actually made a profit since the IPO. In fact, it's made big losses, tens of millions of euros.
Ouch.
Yeah, it's really not looking good.
And over the past year, as the gloomy financial results have piled up for its shareholders, Oatly has been under pressure to announce big changes. There have been a bunch of job cuts, and it was goodbye to Tony Peterson, the singing CEO.
Oh, it's all right, yeah. It's just like milk.
Yeah. Bye, Tony.
Bye, Tony.
Bye, Tony.
He's spending a bit more time on his singing career, I guess.
He's still at the company, but he's co-chairman now. And he's been replaced as CEO by a guy with, I guess you could say, a more corporate kind of background. His name is Jean-Christophe Flatin. He is French and he worked at Mars for 30 years.
Mars as in the chocolate bar company, not the planet, I presume.
Yeah, the chocolate bar Mars, who do a lot more than make chocolate bars, by the way. They're one of the biggest food companies in the world.
So this new CEO comes in, and if you listen to him talk, he's pretty clear about what his priority is. Here he is on a call with investors in July of this year.
We have one single guiding North Star, which is profitable growth. And myself, the leadership team, the organization is laser focused on delivering full year 2024 positive adjusted EBITDA in order to fuel profitable growth.
What he's saying is, priority number one, in fact, the one single laser focus priority, is profit.
Priority number one is not sustainability. In other words.
During this reporting, I grappled with, is a critique of a company that's trying to do better really what the world needs? The answer is yes.
Otherwise, what the hell are we doing here?
So in this third and final installment of the Oatly Chronicles, we're doing just that, critiquing Oatly. After they got the money, did they stay true to their values?
I think it's worth asking the question. I mean, they should be held to account.
Oatly says change isn't easy. To play the game, to get big enough to even dream of replacing dairy, they need big money.
In order to have the influence that we want on the food system, we have to grow. But we also know that we can't make that expansion without investment.
But what actually happened after Oatly took all that money? Does that profit mandate mean that Oatly has to sacrifice at least some of its ideals? Or is this just what it takes to take on big dairy?
Is new, big, capitalistic Oatly part of the solution or part of the problem?
We need to let go of the idea that it has to be like pure or without fault.
Let's start by looking at one of Oatly's main values, transparency. And it's also a marketing thing. One of their most famous ad slogans is, "Hey, dairy industry, show us your numbers."
I actually even saw in the news the other day that Oatly have decided to offer free advertising space to any dairy company that's willing to openly state their carbon footprint.
Oh yeah, I saw that too.
Their marketing team is so clever.
Yeah, they really are. And their message is very much the meat and dairy industry is not transparent and Oatly is different. Here's Oatly's chief sustainability officer, Ashley Allen.
Really, Oatly's always been about this kind of radical transparency and really sharing the journey of what we've done. We really want to share sort of the good progress, the bad result, or the difficult challenges that we're trying to work through.
For example, one thing that Oatly did and is really quite proud of is they made this website called Fuck Oatly.
Oatly made a website for itself called Fuck Oatly.
Yeah, it did. There's even another link. You can type in Fuck Fuck Oatly. You can type in Fuck 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 Oatly. They all work.
Oh,
I'm going to go for Fuck 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 Oatly, just for fun.
Okay. I am looking at the website now, a time machine of all things bad about an oat drink company. It's very self-deprecating and cartoony and has all that nice Oatly branding and even a cartoon of Tony in the corner.
Oh, and here's the bit about the big Blackstone investment that we talked about last week. And a quote, "A look back at when thousands of people from across the world joined hands in the global boycott of Oatly simply for adding a new investor." It's kind of like weirdly passive aggressive.
It is.
It's like strangely defensive.
Oh my God, it's so sarcastic.
I can kind of see what they're trying to do with this website. Being like, yeah, we're not afraid of criticism. But at the tone of it ends up looking like they really do hate the criticism. But anyway, cats, I guess the general vibe of this website is, look at us. We're super transparent.
Yeah, and it's not just this website. Oatly actually does something that is really helpful from the perspective of nosy journalists like us. Oatly has been tracking stuff like its carbon footprint and energy use for years. And rather conveniently, it publishes this information in an annual sustainability report for anyone to look through. Here's Oatly's Ashley Allen again.
and doing so in a way that kind of speaks to people, not like your traditional corporate sustainability report. So not to be something that just sits on a website as a PDF and no one ever looks at, but really something that's an interactive, you know, web type format that kind of engages people and helps walk them through the journey.
And lucky for you, Dominic, we made it our business to comb through all of these reports.
I can just imagine you, Kat, sitting by the pool over the summer with all these Oatly sustainability reports.
Oh, I have to confess that I started reading these like 5 years before we actually reported the story.
I'm really glad we've given you an outlet, finally, on this podcast to share all your knowledge about this oat milk company from Sweden. Tell us, what have you found in this endless reading of sustainability reports?
So, as we talked about in episode one, it is super important to keep in mind that oat milk has a fraction of the impact of cow's milk. But if we just look at Oatly, the bottom line is that the footprint has grown noticeably in a couple of pretty significant ways since the company's gotten bigger. They've been consistently missing their own goals. In 2016, they had set a goal to reduce emissions per litre by 25%. But instead, they've been moving in the opposite direction. Mm. Barring a slight dip in 2022, their emissions have gone up per litre every single year.
That's really the opposite of what I was hoping.
But Ashley, Oatly's chief sustainability officer, frames this as just part of the journey.
I would say the other challenge is really something I would call kind of growing pains.
Because they're opening all these factories across the world, she argues that means fewer emissions from shipping cartons of OT liquid all around the world.
But you're also starting a brand new factory where things take a while to get up to the same level of efficiency.
You'd hope that at some point you'd have all these factories, they'd be established and streamlined, and you'd get more efficient per liter. And the cynic in me thinks maybe they've just lost sight of the sustainability priority while they're focusing on this big expansion. But the optimist in me hopes, well, maybe we're just not there yet.
But I get the impression you're not at the end of your list of Oatly sustainability controversies. What have you got for me next, Katz?
Nope, there's more. While combing through these reports, something pretty major came up, and it has to do with a byproduct of making oat milk. Oat residue.
Oat residue doesn't sound so delicious. What is it?
Yeah, it really doesn't sound good. Very conveniently, Oatly has a page on their website about it. Let me show you.
The subheading says, it's a bit gross.
Yeah, so if you scroll to step two.
Ooh, brown sludge.
If you imagine it's not coming out of that disgusting pipe and it's like coming out of a beautiful bowl, it would just look like porridge.
I don't like how he's like handling it with his gloved hand. That's making me...
No, neither do I.
Very uncomfortable.
Okay, so what he's handling is this leftover from the process. It's like this thick porridgey paste, oat residue. And it is super nutritious. A ton of the protein and the nutrients of the oats is actually in the paste rather than the milk. Mm. So it would be a damn shame to throw it away. But what do you do with it? Now, there is another person on this planet who has spent a lot of time combing through these sustainability reports. And that person is Lisa von der Velde.
We're not alone.
You've got a friend.
Thank God. Now, Lisa is an investigative journalist who also looked into Oatly extensively for Financiële Dagblad.
It's like the Financial Times in the Netherlands.
And she actually stumbled into this story through someone she kind of knew.
Well, actually, it was a big farmer.
This farmer was a friend of a friend.
He was a little bit amused that Oatly was having a lot of critiques on the dairy industry and on the meat industry. But actually, he was working together with them.
What?
He was getting the residues from Oatly, paying that and feeding it to his pigs.
Wait. So the pig farmer was buying the oat residue from Oatly to feed his animals?
Yep, he was. The divisions between the meat industry and the plant milk industry start to be not so clear at all.
So I decided to look into it.
And Lisa first thought, huh, maybe this arrangement is just a one-off thing. But it turns out to be way more systemic. And it's not just Oatly. A lot of other plant-based milks are doing the exact same thing. Like, you know, Alpro, the big soy milk and soy yogurt brand?
Yeah.
They sell their soy residue to dairy farms. So this whole animal feed thing is on the Fuck Oatly website. They call it the residue ruckus, and they write, in 2018, we learned a really valuable lesson. Don't sell your oat residue to pig farms. And then follows this text, which I read like four times, and it's pretty woolly. Like, I don't think I would have ever known for sure that they were still selling this residue to pig farmers if it weren't for Lisa's reporting, plus reading all the way through every single link available in the fairly well-buried PDFs. And there I finally read, in 2022, 59% of Oatly's oat residue was still sold to animal feed companies, up from 36% in 2021.
I mean, having looked at that Fuck Oatly page, I was actually genuinely quite shocked. I couldn't believe it was so brazen, as if they're not doing it anymore.
Yeah, right? I was quite amazed.
We have not learned our lesson.
They really haven't.
I know. And I mean, guess what is not on the friendly animated version of the sustainability report? The fact that it sells its oat residue as pig food.
I mean, I can understand why they didn't want to get someone to illustrate the oat residue being eaten by the pigs. But it does sound a bit shady.
They could have just used the bubbly font.
Yeah.
Instead, I had to click on this bit where it says, click here for the full update written in detailed, legally correct language. And then you have to scroll through this much longer PDF to read about the fact that it's still in the business of selling to animal feed. Mm. So it's true that ultimately I could dig it up, but man, was it well buried.
Yeah.
So just to spell out the contradiction here, Oatly's own marketing is based on this premise that oat milk is better for the planet because cow milk is horribly unsustainable, and that Oatly is way better than the dairy industry because it's way more transparent. But at the same time, it's kind of low-key selling its own waste as animal feed. I mean, like, what did Oatly say when you asked them about it?
Well, something I noticed on the most recent sustainability report is that 59% of the oat residue is still being sold as animal feed. Doesn't that directly contradict this mission of Oatly leading a plant-based revolution to have such a direct relationship with the animal industry?
We are not a sort of anti-animal company by any stretch of the imagination. And many of the farmers that we work with around the world on oats also own animals. And so we see animal feed as a more sustainable option than putting to landfill. None of it gets to landfill.
Maybe feeding this oat residue stuff to pigs or cows is more sustainable than just chucking it away. But is that really the only option?
Yeah, the way they frame it, it's like a choice, landfill or animal feed. But when Lisa asked a bunch of food system scientists,
their main critique point was it's actually a waste that we feed it to animals and that we don't do something with it that's for humans.
Especially because as unappealing as it might look coming out of those industrial pipes, it is so damn nutritious. It's like very fancy animal feed. And that was actually my first thought when I came across this animal feed story. Like, the oats have been approved to be food safe. It's super nutritious. Like, surely you could make, I don't know, oat cookies or something out of it. Flapjacks?
And is anyone actually doing that?
Is anyone making flapjacks out of this questionable oat residue?
Actually, people are making more food for humans, including a company in Oatly's own home country of Sweden.
Oh.
This company is called Elio, and they made a drying machine that turns the residue into powder. And actually, you can use this powder for almost everything. They given me a lot of food that they made with it, and it was actually delicious, quite moist. So it is possible, and there's a plant-based company. It's called The Green Dairy.
The Green Dairy is using this oat powder to make a bunch of things, including plant-based ice cream.
Ooh, ice cream.
One of their clients is IKEA, and IKEA is a big player.
Okay, so if IKEA is selling oat ice cream made out of this oat milk residue, why isn't Oatly? This sounds like right up Oatly's alley.
Yeah, that's what I thought. And when I asked Ashley, like, why can't Oatly find an alternative too? She basically said, we're looking into it.
That's something that we are absolutely committed to exploring. We've done a number of projects. We've had a number of good leads on that, and we continue to research it, but we haven't found the final solution for that yet.
I have to say I'm like a little bit torn about this somewhat secretive animal feed link because yes, it's hypocritical, but on the other hand, isn't feeding pigs leftover oat residue better than the alternative, which is imported soy from, like, Brazil.
Yeah, I had the same thought. Like, I would definitely pick this over Amazon deforestation. But I have to say, it felt a bit jarring to spend a bunch of time reading into how urgent it is that we dismantle animal farming, spurred on by Oatly's big marketing campaigns, and then to learn that a core part of their production chain is so directly linked with the meat industry. And this particular choice makes it so easy for customers to feel betrayed and demotivated, like, why am I eating vegan if you're doing this? But the main sticking point for me was, if they are the kings of radical transparency, it feels like such a missed opportunity as a company that does better to say, hey, this is a problem across the plant-based industry. And there's a solution. We've set an example.
I do wonder whether this same decision would have been made if they didn't have all these profit-driven investors. I mean, I don't know.
I wonder that too. I mean, we can only speculate as to whether that's to do with investment pressure. But this choice also made Lisa question Oatly's priorities.
Every year they're saying, oh, we're close, or we're doing this. But then they're saying, oh, it's still too hard. So when you look at Oatly, you have the feeling that since 2018, they're keeping on saying, almost there, but they're never there yet. And it's not impossible, as I saw in Sweden. So it is possible for Oatly as well. But I think if they really made it a priority, then they would have solved this case by now.
A lot of people who've criticized Oatly would simply say they are holding Oatly to their own standards. People like Thinlay Nguyen, investigative reporter for Lighthouse Reports on food systems.
Not to bash Oatly, but Oatly does pride itself as being better. It has taken out advertisements. Oh, we want to be better than the dairy companies now. Well, then be better. Why be the same?
Do you think we can hold these plant-based companies to higher standards?
We should. I think we should. I think it's worth asking the question. I mean, they should be held to account. You know, just because what they're doing is better than what Big Dairy is doing doesn't mean they should be left off the hook on everything.
To Oatly's credit, you know, they have attracted all of this criticism partly because the company gives its critics loads of ammunition by publishing all of this information about its production processes.
Yeah, but at the same time, I have to admit that while reporting on this story, it hasn't always felt like Oatly is as radically upfront as it says it is.
Yeah, I felt that too. I mean, like, the pig feed wasn't the only thing where it felt like, Oatly isn't exactly going out of its way to communicate with its customers where its shortcomings are. Like, while we were combing through all of these Oatly reports over the summer, one other thing that I noticed was that the proportion of Oatly's own staff who feel like sustainability is really at the heart of everything they do, that has been going down every year for the last few years. And for me, that's another quite damning sign that, yeah, this company has changed as it's got bigger. But Oatly has changed the way that that information is presented in the reports. So it's harder to make the comparisons.
It'd be unfair to portray them as completely untransparent. Like, we did ask them outright about a bunch of these things. But there really are quite a few things. Like, another one is that they have taken down their sustainability reports from before 2020. And finally, after a couple of requests, they sent me 2019, but not the others. And I mean, they said, like, you know, we've changed the way we measure things a lot, so this may be a case to be made. But the tone was very friendly. It was like, oh, nothing to hide here. And it was just like,
to send the documents.
Okay, but
nothing to hide, but you cannot see these documents.
And actually, I spoke to a former employee of Oatly who asked to stay anonymous. And one of their main critiques was that Oatly wasn't fully living up to its transparency statements, especially when they talked to journalists. And the way this former employee saw it, Oatly was doing itself a disservice because it doesn't actually have that much to hide. But not being more transparent sows suspicion. Now, Dominic, your question at the beginning was, is Oatly saving the planet by playing the big green capitalism game?
Yeah, and where's my answer?
We're trying, but it's complicated.
Let's zoom out for a minute and think about what it would take for plant-based milk to go really mainstream. For now, a major factor that is keeping cow milk in a lot of our diets is price.
It is crazy how much more expensive oat milk is than cow milk, because it's just oats and water, essentially, right?
I will say that I spoke to a lot of oat milk producers and they do not love the narrative of it's just oats and water.
There's enzymes.
It's a heating process.
I'd been wondering when price would come up, because right now it feels like oat milk is priced as a kind of bougie product that's only accessible for middle-class people.
Yeah, and cheaper plant milk would be better for the planet because more people would drink it. This is one of those few points that all of my food systems people agreed on. Ultimately, the plant-based revolution is just going to have to leave the €4 barista cappuccino realm if we're really serious about saving the planet. A lot of people say that for our economy to become sustainable, we're going to need regulation. But actually, it's not like we just have a free market now. There is a bunch of regulation propping up the dairy industry. Mm. A large part of the problem here in the EU is those massive EU subsidies keeping animal products artificially cheap. Here is what climate journalist George Monbiot had to say.
Dairy milk is artificially cheap, you know, and the dairy farmers would be the first to tell you that. You know, they're quite right about that. I mean, this is madness when you think of what goes into producing that milk. But to get the costs to the point where they reflected the environmental damage, they would have to do things in a completely different way. And we would all be drinking a lot less dairy milk anyway because we just couldn't afford it.
Who knows what dairy would cost compared to oat milk if it actually represented the real cost of CO2 and land use?
And if it didn't get all of those huge EU subsidies.
As for why oat milk is so expensive, well, some of the analysts I spoke to, and Oatly themselves, basically said this is just what it costs to make oat milk.
Why is plant-based dairy so expensive?
Yes, well, that's a really good question. It shouldn't be, basically. And frankly, we are being ripped off. It can't be right. It's that expensive. So, you know, we need to see more competition coming in. It's expensive because we don't know how much it ought to cost.
There's plenty of evidence that plant milks cost just a fraction of what we are being charged to make. That said, compared to dairy, oat milk is still a relatively new product. And expanding is not cheap. Here's Lisa again, the investigative reporter.
It's really expensive to design a product, and the factories are expensive, and the scale-up is expensive. And in Oatly's case, the marketing is really expensive because they said, okay, let's go big.
Now, the hope is, of course, the investments will pay off, the costs will go down. But of course, they then have to choose to shift from growing and profit to focusing on efficiency and affordability. Now, obviously, plant milk absolutely has the cards financially stacked against them. Lots of people are calling for drastically moving those dairy subsidies over to subsidize plant-based dairy. And there are some examples, actually, like IKEA, where big companies have opted to make the plant-based options cheaper than the dairy options. And you do see that it works. People eat more plant-based than dairy.
Wow, I'm actually quite surprised. That's cool.
Yeah, it is. So it's also up to companies like Oatly. How low are they willing to set their prices? There's one more controversy we need to discuss that really speaks to whether Oatly's priorities are still focused on defeating big dairy.
Right. Did they change when they took these big investments on?
For some Oatly fans, an external sign that priorities had fundamentally shifted was actually a lawsuit that Oatly launched against a plant milk competitor, the Glebe Farm case.
Yes. Back in 2021, Oatly sued a much smaller oat milk brand. And Oatly sued them because they called their milk pure oaty, O-A-T-Y, which Oatly argued was a little too close to their own name.
I'm actually just Googling these cartons of Glebe Farm pure oaty, and I would maybe be a bit more sympathetic to Oatly if the cartons were like clearly piggybacking onto Oatly's success. But the branding is nothing like Oatly's branding. So it's not like anyone's going to mistake this as a bottle of Oatly.
Oatly ended up losing that case. And for some activists like Laura Young, this lawsuit left a really bad taste in their mouth.
And you think, well, hold on a minute, hold on. You want everybody to have oat milk and plant-based choices, but you're kind of attacking the small guys, and it just all didn't sit well. And I think that's been the really sad part, is about being a really great disruptor to now conforming and almost trying to get us to buy into, yes, let's make Oatly a monopoly, when that's not why I bought them in the beginning, and that's not what I want around the world.
publicly at least, Oatly has said it welcomes competition. The more the merrier. But to critics like Laura, this was a sign that Oatly was putting profit above their plant-based revolution.
Now, Oatly have disagreed with the characterization that this is them behaving like a big, bad oat milk monopoly. They defended this lawsuit by saying, you know, listen, we're just protecting our trademark. This is what any company would do.
But I have to say, to me, this court case felt like a weirdly unnecessary thing to do. Like, especially because Oatly has characterized itself as, well, a company that is different. So why all of a sudden do what any company would do? But remember, the odd thing is, even if Oatly is expensive, the company is actually really struggling.
I mean, my main concern about Oatly is that they're having a lot of actual commercial and business difficulties.
That's Sonali Figueras, editor-in-chief of the food systems news site Green Queen. Because remember, after Oatly launched its IPO, things went badly for them. They had these huge losses, they replaced their CEO. And the fact that Oatly's struggling, that is arguably concerning on a planetary level. Because as we've established, we urgently need to shift away from animal products. So it's worrying if a beacon like Oatly doesn't do well.
What's going on? Why is their stock down, you know, 94%? If they go below a dollar for a month, you know, they might get delisted from the New York Stock Exchange, which is a really negative symbol for the alternative dairy industry, because Oatly is really a company that so many of us look up to. Their marketing is truly pioneering. You know, they really did something.
I actually just looked it up, and what Sonali was fearing has come true. And Oatly's share price actually has been under a dollar for more than a month now. So the New York Stock Exchange really could start the procedure to kick them off the stock exchange, which would be terrible news for the planet and potentially for Oprah and Blackstone.
Poor Oprah, poor Blackstone.
So my concern is, you know, can they overcome all these issues, and did they expand too fast? Or is it just that, you know, they're a victim of their own success where they really pioneered this category and everyone else showed up and there are now hundreds of oat milk brands?
Privately, the anonymous former employee told me that that is exactly it. That by far the biggest shift they've noticed is that Oatly is feeling the competition. They were used to being the only ones, and with their main rival focus being Big Dairy. But now there are loads of other brands, and they are feeling the market pressure.
You may have noticed a lot of cows on vacation lately. Let me explain.
It's because of Ripple, an amazing plant-based milk.
Wunda!
Ondertussen vreest een koffie te verwateren als plant-based cappuccino.
Wow, that looks f***ing good.
Oito em cada dez confirmam. O sabor parece leite.
So it's perfect for all vegan and vegan wannabes.
And speaking of Big Dairy, I mean, they seem to be doing just fine, right? Like, we're still drinking more cow milk than ever.
Yeah, it's still going up, at least in Europe and the US. But we are at a point where the milk wars we talked about in episode one that started in Sweden have actually gone international. Here's Got Milk's 2023 ad, not even really focusing on milk, but instead a satire bashing plant-based milk.
Hi, I'm Aubrey Plaza. You know me as an actress, but I'm also the co-founder of Wood Milk, the world's first and only milk made from wood. Wood milk started with a simple idea. I saw a tree and I asked myself, can I drink this? Squished into a slime that's legal to sell.
I don't get this. Why is Aubrey Plaza? What's going on here?
Is wood milk real? Absolutely not. Only real milk is real. Then what did I invest in?
What a sign of the times.
I can't believe Aubrey Plaza is working for the dairy lobby now. I was such a fan of hers.
Why did Aubrey Plaza do this?
That is a big question I don't know the answer to. But I do think this ad is a sign that even these hugely powerful milk companies are feeling at least a little bit threatened.
Which I guess is a good sign.
Or you could see it as a bad sign that dairy are feeling really confident and have found a way to kind of make this into a culture war like everything else.
Just what we need.
A oh, cats, this has all got ridiculously out of hand. We started with an existential crisis that you had in the supermarket trying to choose which milk to buy. We saw a silly Oatly ad.
Well, no cow.
And now it feels like we've talked about the whole world. Capitalism, housing, democracy, all of it.
Ah, welcome to my brain.
So where does this leave us? What should we be buying in the supermarket?
No, I knew you were going to ask that. And unfortunately, if that was a question we could easily answer, this wouldn't have been a three-part series. We've been looking at one company's choices and asking, can green capitalism save us? Is Oatly part of the solution or the problem? And here's how George Monbiot answered it.
I mean, they're both. They're both, I think. Oatly is playing by the rules of the sector. The rules are wrong. It's profoundly wrong.
It's both.
It's both.
Which kind of feels accurate, but a little bit unsatisfying.
Mm-hmm. I know. As Ashley Allen from Oatly put it,
no one single company or country or government or person can solve any of these global challenges alone. And I guarantee you that some other company is facing the same challenges.
A small part of me does wonder if we are being unfairly hard on Oatly. Like, we've established there are way worse players in the food industry. Should we be giving Oatly a break?
Yeah, when it comes to Oatly, I think they've taken on a lot. And I think that ultimately they are imperfect. And we still need a big player like them stirring up the huge problems we have with how we make our food. Thing is, Oatly has been a door in to our incredibly complicated and troubled food systems. And I can't give you a super satisfying answer on what to buy, but I do think we have three really important takeaways here.
Ooh, hit me.
First, as we've established, as hard as it is, we need to reduce our dairy consumption or eliminate it entirely. That is legit something we as individuals can and should be doing to meaningfully reduce our emissions. So we need alternatives, and Oatly has given us that alternative. And Oatly has really paved the way for so many more options and a much bigger conversation about dairy.
Yeah, we wouldn't be here making a three-part series about plant-based milk if it wasn't for Oatly.
No, we really wouldn't. And I think that's genuinely something to thank them for. Because quitting dairy, that is a massive cultural change for a lot of us.
It's definitely going to be a massive cultural change for me.
It's quite difficult.
But aside from stopping eating cheese, very reluctantly, how can we defeat big dairy?
Well, that brings me to takeaway number two. While companies have a part to play in shifting consumers' choices, they're not enough. We've got all of these subsidies keeping dairy strong, and our food system is so controlled by massive monopolies. Here's George.
We've got enormous corporate concentration right across the food sector, you know, and by comparison to, say, Cargill or Archer Daniels Midland or Bunge or Dreyfus, Oatly are tiny. You know, they're very small fry by comparison to those enormous corporations which control a remarkable proportion of the food system. I mean, on one estimate, 90% of the global grain trade is controlled by those four companies. This is far greater concentration than there was in the banks before the financial crash. It's a very dangerous situation indeed.
Our governments have not regulated well, and food system experts say we need way stronger antitrust laws, both in our food system and for our democracy.
Concentration of power in the food systems is a massive, big, big, big problem that just really needs to be solved.
This is investigative journalist Thin Lay Win again.
There should be much stronger and better antitrust laws, right? That says you cannot grow beyond this. But it also means that the whole system in which, you know, the corporate world that we know is built on needs to change, right? Shareholders cannot just always want growth, 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 right? And driving that bad behavior.
I don't know about you guys, but all this talk of monopolies just makes me feel so tiny. And that brings me to takeaway number three. Right at the start, when I told George Monbiot about my existential crisis in the supermarket, he talked about how citizens have been rebranded as customers. And well, there are things we can do to rebrand ourselves back. This is where this series has changed how I shop, at least as one little tiny human.
Tiny little human.
One little tiny human with a branding department behind them. I love this.
Can't wait for Cats to announce her rebrand. Well, what does this rebrand look like, Cats?
Well, I've gotten more and more concerned with this consolidation of wealth and power in companies also just way bigger than Oatly. So now I get a vegetable box every week from a local farmer I know. And then most of the rest of the food I buy comes from this volunteer-run food co-op, which takes me like 3 hours a month, but then I almost never go to the supermarket. And it feels very much worth it given how substantial our food footprint is. But I also know that the vast majority of people, they're just really not going to do this. Mm.
I mean, to me, it's a time issue, right? Like, to be quite honest with you, I have a 5-week-old baby.
What are you doing making a podcast?
It's a very good question.
Well, I can hear in the background.
Screaming in the background. But that aside, I mean, questions of how to shop ethically in the supermarket have temporarily gone out of the window for me. But, you know, when I am through with this new parent stage, I do want to go back to thinking about how to shop ethically. And, you know, ultimately, even after making this whole series, I'm not convinced that Oatly are the absolute worst villains out there. Like, I know a lot more about them as a company than I do about most companies. And that is partly because they've been more transparent than most companies with their customers. And it's also because activists and journalists like us have spent time digging into them. But I still feel like if I pick up some random different oat milk off the shelf, who is to say that they're better or worse than Oatly in terms of their business ethics?
I know. I really notice now that every time I go to the supermarket, I just look at like every single product and I'm like, there's probably a big story behind you as well.
Tune in next week for Alpro, the follow-up.
Listeners, we have a slightly different format from now on.
We're now an exclusively milk-based podcast.
Okay, but to reframe ourselves as citizens, I think we're going to need all of it. We're going to need the consumers like us shifting our diets. We're going to need the big oat milks. We're going to need the small oat milks and political action.
Yeah, exactly that. If anything, this series has inspired me to try and hold our European politicians to account and get them to change their laws so they are not subsidizing the dairy industry.
Yeah.
Because if those dairy subsidies could move, or at least some of them move, towards the plant-based alternatives, it would really change everything. It would mean prices would go down and people would start buying different things.
Yeah, especially because we're in a cost of living crisis. Like, it's already really stressful for people to think about buying their food. And imagine if you went to the supermarket and it didn't depend so much on your choices on that day. If all of the affordable options, those were the ones that were the least damaging for our planet.
We can dream.
We can dream.
I've been doing this for 38 years now. Fundamentally, the big story is the same as it's been throughout my career from when I started when I was 22.
And what makes you hopeful?
What makes me hopeful is other people. All these horrendous things are being thrown at people, and yet people are still protesting. You know, despite these enormous hazards, they're still protesting. And that's where hope lies. It's in the human spirit. It's in the ability to say, no, to hell with you. I'm going to keep going.
This episode was produced by me, Kat Slurslow, and reported by both me and Katie Lee. Editing also came from Katie, as well as the wonderful Justine Paradise, visiting from NPR's excellent podcast, Outside In. Editorial support came from Margot Gibbs, Dominic Kramer, and Wojciech Oleksiak. And mixing, scoring, and sound design also came from the amazing Wojciech. Special thank you to my lovely neighbours, Joris Klinger and Thomas van Dijk, for letting me use their very nice studio for this whole series. You can find their music under Bo for Bure. There'll be a link in the show notes. And of course, thank you to Frederick Gerton, Lisa van der Velder, George Monbiot, Thinley Wynn, Sonali Figueras, Laura Young, Ashley Allen, Sarah Berger, and Boris DeLauren for talking to us. Finally, none of this would have been possible without the generous funding from Journalism Fund Europe, Allianz Foundation, and of course our lovely Patreon supporters. Thank you for helping keep one of the only independent podcasts about Europe going. Hasta la próxima!